GoDaddy.com. Use the code PODSAVE, that's PODSAVE 139, for $5 off of orders that are $30 or more. GoDaddy.com. Tango Tango Papa 1457, January 20th, 2011.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Wilmer, Texas. I was home last night, I was home for probably, 36 hours or something like that. Was able to come through home on my way between the St. Louis area and Waxahachie, Texas. So I left home, I guess it was about 9 o'clock this morning, somewhere around 9 o'clock, left home, and then got down to Waxahachie, I guess it was pushing 5 o'clock, getting close to 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and I had to park on the side of the road there for a little while, on the side road. And wait, my delivery appointment was at 6 p.m. and the place where I was delivering to said right in my directions in there that they would not let you in until 15 minutes, no more than 15 minutes before the delivery appointment. And so I knew that, and so I parked and waited about 45 minutes or so, and then or maybe a little longer. And then went in, and they backed me right into a door. And so I was there, probably a couple of hours anyway. And then they finished, and so then I knew I was going to head back to the Wilmer yard here, the company yard here. And I've written my truck up for the shop to work on it, because I've the past... probably two or three nights that I've slept in the truck, I've smelled a little bit of exhaust fumes, only when the truck is parked and the motor's running. It's particularly noticeable, obviously it was noticeable when I was up there in Wisconsin, where it was very cold and the engine was running a lot with the optimized idle, and so I was definitely smelling it. Now, this evening, here at Wilmer, Texas, I don't know. I'm just making a guess. The temperature's probably in the upper 40s, so the truck isn't running as much, you know, and it's just not as cold. So I came up here and I went in there and wrote the truck up, and from the sounds of it, I'm going to be here probably a good chunk, if not all day tomorrow, because it sounds like this shop is very busy. They've got a lot of work to do. They're sort of backed up, with this sort of problem, smelling and exhaust fumes while you're sleeping, you know, while I'm sleeping in particular, is not good. And so I would, you know, just much better off getting that fixed. And then ever since they worked on it about a month ago, they worked on it in Lincoln, and that was one, it had one of the same problems. I was smelling exhaust fumes when it was, you know, when I was parked in the optimized idle, you know, when the engine was idling. And now one thing I noticed, you know, almost immediately when I left Lincoln, the check engine light was kind of coming on whenever the truck had to pull, whenever the motor would really kind of engage, like going, you know, kind of dragging down where the motor would have to really work to go up a hill or what have you, the check engine light would come on. And so I don't know what was causing that, but there's that problem as well. But otherwise it was running fine. But I can't obviously tolerate smelling exhaust fumes, even a little bit. Now, I've thought in the past about getting a carbon monoxide detector, and then I've thought about it a couple of times, and then I kind of, for some reason, kind of promptly didn't remember it, forgot about it, sort of, and I never have actually remembered to look for them, like if I'm in a department store or what have you. I haven't really thought about looking for them, but so I need to remember to do that, because you can get battery-operated ones that should work fairly well, and obviously if in a vehicle with me sleeping in the vehicle all the time, it would probably be a good idea to actually have a carbon monoxide detector, just in case, because I'm constantly sleeping in this truck, summertime, wintertime, the thing's idling a lot, and now it would kind of be interesting to know, let's say in the typical truck stop parking lot, whether you got a lot of trucks idling, it would be interesting to kind of know what the carbon monoxide level in general was in an area like that. Now there are times when I'm parked in a truck stop parking lot where I'll smell a little bit of exhaust fumes, you know, and so that you do have that. But usually, if it's consistent, especially if the truck's kind of parked by itself and it's kind of consistent, then it's coming from my own exhaust, obviously. But I very rarely, it doesn't happen very often that I smell exhaust fumes in a truck stop parking lot. That's fairly rare, but it would be interesting to be able to measure that. Now, these detectors, they don't really give you any kind of reading or anything that I know of. They simply are designed to respond, you know, with an alarm if the carbon monoxide level goes above a certain point. And that obviously, as I say, vehicle where I'm parked all the time and I'm running that engine a lot to stay warm or stay cool, it would be a good thing to have. And so I need to remember to do that next time I'm in a department store, you know, Walmart or Lowe's or Home Depot or someplace like that. It'd be a good thing to remember to do, to look for. So, I could even look on Amazon. I'm sure they sell them on Amazon.com, and then just find one and order it, and then it would be waiting for me the next time I go home. So, you know, probably beginning of next month sometime. So probably will do that. So anyway, I'm here, and I'm waiting for them to, as I say, it's going to be sometime tomorrow, probably tomorrow afternoon, before they, you know, there's any chance that they're going to work on this. Although they might surprise me. I kind of doubt it the way he was talking. But so if I'm still around tomorrow evening, then I have a niece and her husband that live here in Dallas. And, of course, Wilmer's suburban Dallas. And so if I'm still around tomorrow evening, I don't know if my niece is around, because she travels with her job. She travels a lot during the week. They fly her off to different cities during the week, and then, so I don't know if she's probably gone, but her husband should be around, and so if he's, I don't know, if I'm still around tomorrow evening, I will, you know, kind of contact them, give them a call and see what's going on, and even if she's not around, you know, he can, you know, there's been several times where he's been able to come, and we go somewhere to eat or whatever, and just have, you know, kind of have a nice little time. And so if he's available. Now, if he's not, then if he's busy, then, you know, that's just a thought. But that is a possibility, and I've done that, I don't know, several times with him, a couple of times with him just by himself, and then a couple of times with him and her together. And So that is definitely a viable, you know, it's a, definitely an option. If, as I say, if I'm still around around here tomorrow evening. So anyhow, I've got a couple of different things here. This first thing I'm going to play, you know, I haven't talked about it. I might have mentioned it. You know, there's been this shooting in Arizona, I don't know, I guess about a week ago. And, you know, the news is full of, you know, they've tried to make this guy out, this shooter. They've tried to make this guy out. You know, at first they tried to make him out that he was some sort of right-wing nut. And that it was all this, you know, the right-wing talk radio and so on and so forth, alternative right-wing media that just caused this guy to go ballistic and so on and so forth, and, you know, caused him to shoot, you know, to open fire in the supermarket in Tucson, Arizona, you know, with that congressman and the other people that were gathered there. It was a public meeting of some sort. And so that didn't stick, obviously, because the guy wasn't a right, you know, the guy's nuts. And in fact, the guy's a left, the guy was left wing. You know, he's a Bush hater. You know, one of these people that, you know, basically suffer from a George Bush derangement syndrome, where they just hated Bush with a passion. This guy hated Bush, very left wing, and, you know, with a lot of the stuff that he said, and, you know, the, it hasn't gotten reported a whole lot in the media. It's out there if you want to find it. The guy is, you know, kind of a left-wing nut. And but regardless, the problem is that, you know, whether someone's on the left or I don't care what their politics are, people that are crazy, and this guy had a history of a long history of run-ins with the law, with the local sheriff, who, by the way, down there in Tucson, the local sheriff, I believe it's Pima County, is this guy's just really rabid liberal. And this sheriff has had run-ins with this guy for at least a period of a couple of years. The guy should have been locked up. And there's enough evidence that he could have been locked up if the sheriff would have wanted to. You know, now it's come out that the sheriff, well, the sheriff majored in psychology. And, you know, it's obvious to me that the sheriff is just kind of deciding, well, this guy is, you know, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt or whatever. I don't know. There's no way of knowing, but the guy, it's obvious to me the guy should have been locked up. Had he been locked up, this shooting would have never happened. But we've had this thing, and I've talked about it a long time ago, this thing called deinstitutionalization. It started probably really in the 60s. We started deinstitutionalizing crazy people. Before that, we had state-run mental institutions. The state, you know, you may be shocked to under, you know, I think we as the state, you know, individual states, federal government, or certainly at least the states, we should be taxed as citizens. We should be taxed, and we should pay for mental institutions to put these people away. There are people that cannot take care of themselves. They literally cannot take care of themselves. And so what do? Oh, we're going to mainstream these people. We it's not right. We can't lock these people up. They didn't commit a crime. Well, they do in many cases, so they can be locked up. But in any case, the argument went, oh, we can't lock these people up. They didn't commit a crime. We'll just give them the right drugs and they'll be under control and we're going to mainstream them. And they'll be able to just be normal people. And we'll do away with these evil mental institutions. And so they closed a lot of mental institutions and dumped all these people out on the street, basically. And that's in large part the homeless population. You hear about the homeless population from time to time. A lot of the homeless population is comprised of people that would be in a mental institution, but they're not because we've dumped them out, which is cruel. You know, we want to pay, you know, put perfectly healthy people on welfare, you know, oh, you know, they can't work, they're underprivileged or whatever, they're too stupid to work, so we're going to put them on welfare. They're perfectly able-bodied, they're just lazy. We'll pay to put those people, you know, put those people on welfare. But these crazy people, these people that are really insane, oh, we're not going to, oh, we can't lock them up. We can't put them away. Oh, no, 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 no. We're going to mainstream them. We're going to put them out on the street. That's cruel. So, starting in the 60s, we closed all these mental institutions. And so now we've got all these people, we've got, you know, because there's always a certain percentage of people in the population that are nuts. I mean, that's just a fact of life. There are people that cannot take care of themselves properly. For whatever reason, they're not capable. And if we as a society have any responsibility at all, and we do have a responsibility to at least put these people in a place where they can't hurt themselves or they can't hurt other people, because we're protecting ourselves from them too. It's not just that they might hurt themselves. There's a lot of these people that are actually dangerous, and we need to be protected from them. So we pay to be protected from them. But no, here we are. We throw them out, you know, throw them out on the street. Well, then what happens when they get guns? As in this case of this guy in Arizona, he got a gun. Oh, well then, oh, we're too stupid. We're too crazy as a society. We can't have, we've got to do away with the Second Amendment. And that's the whole point, I think, of deinstitutionalization, is it's an incremental way of saying, oh, your society's gotten so crazy, you can't be trusted with guns. You can't be trusted with free speech. You're just too nuts. All of you are too nuts. We're going to turn the whole society into a giant insane asylum or a giant prison, instead of segregating the people that really are crazy. No, we're going to throw them out into the general population, and then make it seem like society's somehow gotten worse, or it's, you know, and then we'll use that as a way to shut down free speech, use that as a way to shut down the constitutional rights, just shut that down, and then we'll have a state-run dictatorship, and then the state will tell everybody how they're going to live. And so that's basically what's happened. So we need to reinstitutionalize. We need to have a debate. We need, as a society, we need to be building mental institutions and actually putting people away. There are people that cannot take care of themselves. I've periodically over the years, I've had people come up to my truck, you know, they're out on the street. You know, now there's some of them that are just kind of lazy bums or whatever that are kind of walking around begging for money, and a lot of those are professional beggars, by the way. But you have these other ones that just cannot take care of themselves. They're not capable of taking care of themselves, and it's cruel to throw those people out, just toss them out, and expect them to be able to function. They can't function. They cannot function. So. But anyway, so we've had this, you know, the media tried to say, oh, well, you know, our debate, these words, you know, everything's so vitriolic, we got to tone this down. And that's the meme that they've tried to start. And so, but who's putting out the incendiary rhetoric? You know, what President Obama, not that long ago, was saying, well, if they bring a knife to the fight, we'll bring a gun. That seems pretty incendiary to me. And there's plenty of other cases. You know, they even made a movie about some left-wing nutcase even made a movie about how, you know, they were going to assassinate George Bush, writing books about it, and they made a movie about it, fantasizing about it. That seems pretty vitriolic to me. So we have a congressman, a Democrat congressman. What's the fellow's name? Hang on, and I'll tell you. Let's see, YouTube. Let's see. Let me find my file here. Steve Cohen. He's from Tennessee. And he's comparing Nazis, Republicans to Nazis. And so here that is. Here's so much for the civility. You know, it's a case of projection, because the left is the one, primarily. I'm not saying that there aren't some right-wing nutcases. There are, obviously, but it's primarily on the left. The left is where the violence really is, and the violent thoughts certainly are. And so this proves it, you know, and so these people are projecting. They want it to be somebody else, but it's really them that are guilty of it. And so here's Steve Cohen, a Democrat from Tennessee, in the House, comparing Republicans to Nazis.
The nonpartisan, bipartisan Congressional Budget Office says it's going to cost us $230 billion the first decade and $1.2 trillion thereafter. And they say, well, they can have their opinion. Those are facts. Those are nonpartisan facts of people we hire to give us the truth. And they don't like the truth, so they summarily dismiss it. They say it's a government takeover of health care, a big lie, just like Goebbels. You say it enough, you repeat the lie, you repeat the lie, you repeat the lie, and eventually people believe it, like blood libel. That's the same kind of thing. The Germans said enough about the Jews, and the people believed it, and you had the Holocaust. You tell a lie over and over again. And we've heard it on this floor. Government takeover of health care. PolitiFact, nonpartisan, Pulitzer Prize winning, 2009, St. Petersburg Times, said the biggest lie of 2010 was government takeover of health care, because there is no government takeover. It's insurance.
Okay, so twist the words. Now, the problem, you know, he's saying, oh, you repeat the lie, you repeat the lie, you repeat the lie, and people will eventually believe it. Well, if that's the case, and it can be the case, that if you lie to people, that people will believe the lie, well, why? Is it the lie's problem? Is it the lie's fault that people believe the lie? If you believe a lie, if someone scams you, let's say someone scams you, is it the lie's fault that you believed it? No, it's your fault. If someone scams you, you've got a character flaw. If someone is able to scam you, it's because you were looking to get something for nothing. It's because you were looking to be charmed in some way, or someone was telling you what a wonderful person you were. Anytime you get scammed, anytime someone gets scammed, it's the person that gets scammed is primarily they have a character flaw that just got revealed. So the lies are out there, but it comes back to the point: well, why do people believe the lie? And if there are so many people that are going to believe lies, now of course this guy, he's trying to say that it wasn't a government takeover of healthcare. It clearly is. It's just insurance. Everybody has to have insurance. It's unconstitutional. Absolutely unconstitutional for the government to force people, for the Congress to pass laws to force people to buy insurance. And then they try to twist it and they say, oh, it's not. It's just a fine. We're not forcing you to buy insurance, but if you don't buy it, we're going to fine you. We're going to fine your ass. And we're going to have we've hired all these extra IRS people to enforce it. It's ridiculous. It's just, they're twisting words. But regardless, the problem, this guy's, he probably in his own mind, he can twist things, and he believes he's telling the truth. And there's a lot of people that think that way. My mom is a good example. My dad is a good example. They really think that you know, that the Democrat thing is right and it's wrong. And they believe the lies, they repeat the lies, and they really believe the lies are the truth. I'm convinced of it. You can, I've tried to argue sense with them for years, and I can't. You can't get through. They believe that I believe in lies, and that I'm arguing the lie, you know, from a point standpoint of lying. And you know it. They cannot see the truth. But regardless of that, there are people that do believe lies. There are people that want to believe lies. You know, there are people that get caught up, kind of innocently, sort of believing lies. And then they think the lie is the truth, and the truth is lies. Well, how can that be? People have character flaws. And if too many people have too big of character flaws, society's got a problem. That's why morality is very important. Morality is extremely important, because if you have some little perversion and you want to believe that whatever your little brand of perversion is, that is right, and then you get people around you to sort of help you believe that, well, oh, you're really a good person. You know, it's really okay to drink. It's really okay to step out on your wife. It's really okay to step out on your husband. It's really okay to do, you know, to snort, you know, whatever it is you snort. It's really okay. That's really, you know, there are people that are worse. It's really okay to do that. And you get people that agree with you that that right is wrong and wrong is right. Then you're in danger then. You're in serious, serious danger. You begin to believe the truth is the lie and the lie is the truth. The truth becomes offensive. The truth is a threat. And people that speak the truth are a threat. You want to stamp out the truth. And you get people that are in a major denial. So as a society, we face a, you know, there's one problem that's just, you know, we're running into, and we're going to run into it whether we want to or not. And that revolves around our currency and debt. And we're getting to the point, we're very close now, I believe, to the point where our currency is going to end up being devalued in a massive way. It's already happening right now. But, you know, and these things are kind of hard to predict, but it's already happening. You know, you look at the prices of commodities are going up. Well, it's not, you know, normally the prices of commodities might go up if there was high demand for them, but there's not high demand. I mean, you turn on newscasts like I did, you know, I was watching all these, you know, kind of flipping channels, watching local newscasts, like yesterday evening, you know, and you can't turn on something like that without them talking about, you know, in every show or even these talk shows, they're talking about how rotten the economy is and so on and so forth. And so the commodities are not increasing in price because there's demand. The demand is weak. So we have devaluation. We have currency devaluation going on right now. And at some point, people are going to really stampede away from against the dollar, you know, because the dollar, you know, we're in a unique position because, you know, the U.S. dollar has been the world reserve currency. But, you know, so it's not like it's some little South American country that's you know, printing their money out of control and devaluing their currency. the United States has been in a kind of unique position because we were the reserve currency for the world. Well, you know, at some point, that's not going to work anymore. It's really not going to work anymore. We can't just print and spend and spend and print and borrow and spend and print and continue to do that. It's not possible. And so, you know, it's really hard to say when, but at some point, something drastic is going to happen. It's kind of like somebody, you know, you do a look at someone, you know, an individual that's taking drugs, or they're let's say it's an alcoholic, and they've drank to the point where they've ruined their liver. They got cirrhosis of the liver, and they're about to drop dead, and yet, you know, here they are just, you know, continuing to drink, you know, because it's, well, they get rid of the, you know, they're going to die, so let's just, you know, live it up. It's kind of the mentality. Someone that's in denial, you know, and it's the same with a society, except it's just on a larger scale. It's the same principles are involved, and so. But the problem with society is it's made up of individual people. Individual people are in denial. And individual people have lost their way, or from, you know, lost their moral compass. They've lost their way. And there's too many people that despise the truth. There are too many people that believe that the truth is a lie and a lie is the truth. They're threatened by the truth. And it's really a serious problem. So anyway, it's going to be interesting. As I say, it's hard to predict these things and when they're going to happen, but nonetheless, you can't. There are certain things you can't do, and we're doing them as a society, and they're not sustainable. I've got another piece of audio here. Now, this is about I don't know, it's probably about 25 minutes long. And this is a piece of audio from one of the TED Talks. This gal's name is Shaina Iyengar. And she's talking about choice. And, you know, and she's arguing that, oh, you know, in the United States we've got too much choice. Too much choice. And at how much better it is, you know, in societies that don't have as much choice, how much more wonderful it is. And she's trying to argue that, you know, she's trying to make the argument. And it's basically, the woman is a liberal. It's painfully obvious. You can hear arrogance in her voice. And, you know, she's kind of arguing against, you know, individuality, and she's kind of arguing in favor of sort of the collective and all this gobbledygook. And you just know that the woman is a liberal. You know that she's probably, you know, almost arguing in favor of communism without saying so. So anyway, I'm going to go ahead and play this. And I'll probably end up stopping this. I don't know if I'm going to play the whole thing, because she kind of drones on and on and on. But, you know, you can definitely hear the arrogance in her voice. So here it is, a TED Talk. A woman's name is Shaina Iyengar, and she's talking about making choices.
Today I'm going to take you around the world in 18 minutes. My base of operations is in the U.S., but let's start at the other end of the map, in Kyoto, Japan, where I was living with a Japanese family while I was doing part of my dissertational research 15 years ago. I knew even then that I would encounter cultural differences and misunderstandings, but they popped up when I least expected it. On my first day, I went to a restaurant and I ordered a cup of green tea with sugar. After a pause, the waiter said, "One does not put sugar in green tea." "I know," I said, "I'm aware of this custom, but I really like my tea sweet." In response, he gave me an even more courteous version of the same explanation. One does not put sugar in green tea. I understand, I said, that the Japanese do not put sugar in their green tea, but I'd like to put some sugar in my green tea. Surprised by my insistence, the waiter took up the issue with the manager. Pretty soon, a lengthy discussion ensued, and finally the manager came over to me and said, "I am very sorry, we do not have sugar." Well, since I couldn't have my tea the way I wanted it, I ordered a cup of coffee, which the waiter brought over promptly. Resting on the saucer were two packets of sugar. My failure to procure myself a cup of sweet green tea was not due to a simple misunderstanding. This was due to a fundamental difference in our ideas about choice. From my American perspective, when a paying customer makes a reasonable request based on her preferences, she has every right to have that request met. The American way, to quote Burger King, is to have it your way, because as Starbucks says, happiness is in your choices. But from the Japanese perspective, it's their duty to protect those who don't know any better. In this case, the ignorant gaijin for making the wrong choice. Let's face it, the way I wanted my tea was inappropriate according to cultural standards, and they were doing their best to help me save face. Americans tend to believe that they've reached some sort of pinnacle in the way they practice choice. They think that choice is seen through the American lens best fulfills an innate and universal desire for choice in all humans. Unfortunately, these beliefs are based on assumptions that don't always hold true. In many countries, in many cultures, at times they don't even hold true at America's own borders. I'd like to discuss some of these assumptions and the problems associated with them. As I do so, I hope you'll start thinking about some of your own assumptions and how they were shaped by your backgrounds. First assumption: if a choice affects you, then you should be the one to make it. This is the only way to ensure that your preferences and interests will be most fully accounted for. It is essential for success. In America, the primary locus of choice is the individual. People must choose for themselves, sometimes sticking to their guns, regardless of what other people want or recommend. It's called being true to yourself. But do all individuals benefit from taking such an approach to choice? Mark Lipper and I did a series of studies in which we sought the answer to this very question. In one study, which we ran in Japantown, San Francisco, we brought 7 to 9-year-old Anglo and Asian American children into the laboratory, and we divided them up into three groups. The first group came in, and they were greeted by Miss Smith, who showed them 6 big piles of anagram puzzles. The kids got to choose which pile of anagrams they would like to do, and they even got to choose which marker they would write their answers with. When the second group of children came in, they were brought to the same room, shown the same anagrams, but this time Miss Smith told them which anagrams to do and which markers to write their answers with. Now, when the third group came in, they were told that their anagrams and their markers had been chosen by their mothers. In reality, the kids who were told what to do, whether by Miss Smith or their mothers, were actually given the very same activity which their counterparts in the first group had freely chosen. With this procedure, we were able to ensure that the kids across the three groups all did the same activity, making it easier for us to compare performance. Such small differences in the way we administered the activity yielded striking differences in how well they performed. Anglo-Americans, they did 2.5 times more anagrams when they got to choose them as compared to when it was chosen for them by Miss Smith or their mothers. It didn't matter who did the choosing. If the task was dictated by another, their performance suffered. In fact, some of the kids were visibly embarrassed when they were told that their mothers had been consulted. One girl named Mary said, "You asked my mother?" In contrast, Asian American children performed best when they believed their mothers had made the choice. Second best when they chose for themselves, and least well when it had been chosen by Miss Smith. A girl named Natsumi even approached Miss Smith as she was leaving the room and tugged on her skirt and asked, "Could you please tell my mommy I did it just like she said?" The first generation children were strongly influenced by their immigrant parents' approach to choice. For them, choice was not just a way of defining and asserting their individuality, but...
Okay, now, let me interrupt. What she's measuring there is basically programming. How are the kids programmed? You know, and let's face it, you know, kids... Right in the Bible, it says you were first of earth and then of spirit. And so basically, the kids are of earth and they're programmed. You know, we're programmed by our environment. If you're born in Borneo, you'd end up being a cannibal. And you're born in America, you're an American. And so there's basically, she's sort of measuring. You know, she's saying, well, they're first-generation immigrants. Well, you know, measure them later and see how it works. You know, because you're measuring, you're measuring programming.
But a way to create community and harmony by deferring to the choices of people whom they trusted and respected. If they had a concept of being true to oneself, then that self most likely composed not of an individual, but of a collective. Success was just as much about pleasing key figures as it was about satisfying one's own preferences. Or you could say that the individual's preferences were shaped by the preferences of specific others. The assumption, then, that we do best when the individual self chooses only holds when that self is clearly divided from others. When, in contrast, two or more individuals see their choices and their outcomes as intimately connected, then they may amplify one another's success by turning choosing into a collective act. To insist that they choose independently might actually compromise both their performance and their relationships. Yet that is exactly what the American paradigm demands. It leaves little room for interdependence or an acknowledgement of individual fallibility. It requires that everyone treat choice as a private and self-defining act. People that have grown up in such a paradigm might find it motivating, but it is a mistake to assume that everyone thrives under the pressure of choosing alone. The second assumption, which informs the American view of choice, goes something like this. The more choices you have, the more likely you are to make the best choice. So bring it on, Walmart with 100,000 different products and Amazon with 27 million.
Okay, now, Walmart, you know, and I guarantee you, liberal hates Walmart. Oh, I hate Walmart. Walmart's evil. Well, here she is, you know, denigrating Walmart. And what's one of the biggest way they the ways they do it? It moves into a city or moves into a town. Walmart moves into a town and it closes down all these extra businesses, runs mom and pop out of business. Well, you're limiting choices. Isn't that good? Isn't that what you want? Limited choices. Let's just have one store, one giant store instead of all these extra little tiny stores that are all competing with each other, little mom and pop places that charge too much. Let's just have one choice. Let's make it easy and just have one place to go, one stop, and get rid of the choices. That's what they want, but I guarantee you she's you know, typical liberal, hates Walmart, you know, hates big business. Well, you know, that's limiting choice. So, you know, it's a contradiction.
$1 million and Match.com with, 15 million date possibilities now? You will surely find the perfect match. Let's test this assumption by heading over to Eastern Europe. Here I interviewed people who were residents of formerly communist countries who had all faced the challenge of transitioning to a more democratic and capitalistic society. One of the most interesting revelations came not from an answer to a question, but from a simple gesture of hospitality. When the participants arrived for their interview, I offered offered them a set of drinks. Coke, Diet Coke, Sprite, 7 to be exact. During the very first session, which was run in Russia, one of the participants made a comment that really caught me off guard. Oh, but it doesn't matter. It's all just soda. That's just one choice. I was so struck by this comment that from then on I started to offer all the participants those 7 sodas, and I asked them, how many choices are these? Again and again, they perceived these 7 different sodas not as 7 choices, but as one choice, soda or no soda. When I put out juice and water in addition to these 7 sodas, now they perceived it as only 3 choices, juice, water, and soda. Compare this to the diehard devotion of many Americans, not just to a particular flavor of soda, but to a particular brand. You know, research shows repeatedly that we can't actually tell the difference between Coke and Pepsi. Of course, you and I know that Coke is the better choice. For modern Americans who are exposed to more options and more ads associated with options than anyone else in the world, choice is just as much about who they are as it is about what the product is. Combine this with the assumption that more choices are always better, and you have a group of people for whom every little difference matters, and so every choice matters. But for Eastern Europeans, the sudden availability of all these consumer products on the marketplace was a deluge. They were flooded with choice before they could protest that they didn't know how to swim. When asked, what words and images do you associate with choice? Gregers from Warsaw said, ah, for me it is fear. There are some dilemmas, you see. I am used to no choice. Bodin from Kiev said, in response to how he felt about the new consumer marketplace, it is too much. We do not need everything that is there. A sociologist from the Warsaw Survey Agency explained, the older generation jumped from nothing to choice all around them. They were never given a chance to learn how to react. And Tomasz, a young Polish man, said, I do not need 20 kinds of chewing gum. I don't mean to say that I want no choice, but many of these choices are quite artificial. In reality, many choices are between things that are not that much different. The value of choice depends on our ability to perceive differences between the options. Americans train their whole lives to play spot the difference. They practice this from such an early age that they've come to believe that everyone must be born with this ability. In fact, though all humans share a basic need and desire for choice, we don't all see choice in the same places or to the same extent. When someone can't see how one choice is unlike another, or when there are too many choices to compare and contrast, the process of choosing can be confusing and frustrating. Instead of making better choices, we become overwhelmed by choice, sometimes even afraid of it. Choice no longer offers opportunities, but imposes constraints. It's not a marker of liberation, but of suffocation by meaningless minutia. In other words, choice can develop into the very opposite of everything it represents in America when it is thrust upon those who are insufficiently prepared for it. But it is not only other people in other places that are feeling the pressure of ever-increasing choice. Americans themselves are discovering that unlimited choice seems more attractive in theory than in practice. We all have physical, mental, and emotional limitations that make it impossible for us to process every single choice we encounter, even in the grocery store, let alone over the course of our entire lives. A number of my studies have shown that when you give people 10 or more options when they're making a choice...
Now, do you hear the arrogance in her voice? My studies, I had this study. You can hear it. Her voice is dripping with arrogance as she's kind of talking about this. You know, she would love to make choices for other people. You know, she's the type of person that would love to be the one making choices for people, and you should just shut up and just listen to her choices, you know, and worship her as the choice giver, you know, as the chooser.
They make poorer decisions, whether it be healthcare, investment, other critical areas. Yet still, many of us believe that we should make all our own choices and seek out even more of them. This brings me to the third and perhaps most problematic assumption. You must never say no to choice. To examine this, let's go back to the US and then hop across the pond to France. Right outside Chicago, a young couple, Susan and Daniel Mitchell, were about to have their first baby. They'd already picked out a name for her, Barbara, after her grandmother. One night when Susan was 7 months pregnant, she started to experience contractions and was rushed to the emergency room. The baby was delivered through a C-section, but Barbara suffered cerebral anoxia, a loss of oxygen to the brain. Unable to breathe on her own, she was put on a ventilator. 2 days later, the doctors gave the Mitchells a choice. They could either remove Barbara off the life support, in which case she would die within a matter of hours, or they could keep her on life support, in which case she might still die within a matter of days. If she survived, she would remain in a permanent vegetative state, never able to walk, talk, or interact with others. What do they do? What do any parent do? In a study I conducted with Simona Botti and Christina Orfale, American and French parents were interviewed. They had all suffered the same tragedy. In all cases, the life support was removed and the infants had died. But there was a big difference. In France, the doctors decided whether and when the life support would be removed, while in the United States, the final decision rested with the parents. We wondered, does this have an effect on how the parents cope with the loss of their loved one? We found that it did. Even up to a year later, American parents were more likely to express negative emotions as compared to their French counterparts. French parents were more likely to say things like, "Noah was here for so little time, but he taught us so much. He gave us a new perspective on life." American parents were more likely to say things like, "What if? What if?" Another parent complained, "I feel as if they purposely tortured me. How did they get me to do that?" And another parent said, "I feel as if I've played a role in an execution." But when the American parents were asked if they would rather have had the doctors make the decision, they all said no. They could not imagine turning that choice over to another, even though having made that choice made them feel trapped, guilty, angry. In a number of cases, they were even clinically depressed. These parents could not contemplate giving up the choice because to do so would have gone contrary to everything they had been taught and everything they had come to believe about the power and purpose of choice. In her essay, The White Album, Joan Didion writes, "We tell ourselves stories in order to live. We interpret what we see, select the most workable of the multiple choices. We live entirely by the imposition of a narrative line upon disparate images, by the idea with which we learn to freeze, the shifting phantasmagoria, which is our actual experience." The story Americans tell, the story upon which the American dream depends, is the story of limitless choice. This narrative promises so much: freedom, happiness, success. It lays the world at your feet and says, "You can have anything. Everything. It's a great story, and it's understandable why they would be reluctant to revise it.
Now, why does she want... And it's understandable why they would be reluctant to revise it. Well, why does she want to revise it? Why would anybody want to revise it? See, there it is again. She's... You know, there's this agenda that these people have that... we have to revise this. We have to, and basically she's wanting people to be slaves. Just shut up, slave. Be a good slave. Someone else will make the decision. The state will make the decision for you. The collective will make the decision for you. That's what she's arguing in favor of.
But when you take a close look, you start to see the holes. And you start to see that the story can be told in many other ways. Americans have so often tried to disseminate their ideas of choice, believing that they will be or ought to be welcomed with open hearts and minds. But the history books and the daily news tell us it doesn't always work out that way. The phantasmagoria, the actual experience that we try to understand and organize through narrative, varies from place to place. No single narrative serves the needs of everyone, everywhere. Moreover, Americans themselves could benefit from incorporating new perspectives into their own narrative, which has been driving their choices for so long. Robert Frost once said that it is poetry that is lost in translation. This suggests that whatever is beautiful and moving, whatever gives us a new way to see, cannot be communicated to those who speak a different language. But Joseph Brodsky said that it is poetry that is gained in translation, suggesting that translation can be a creative, transformative act. When it comes to choice, we have far more to gain than to lose by engaging in the many translations of the narratives. Instead of replacing one story with another, we can learn from and revel in the many versions that exist and the many that have yet to be written. No matter where we're from and what your narrative is, we all have a responsibility to open ourselves up to a wider array of what choice can do and what it can represent. And this does not lead to a paralyzing moral relativism. Rather, it teaches us when and how to act. It brings us that much closer to realizing the full potential of choice, to inspiring the hope and achieving the freedom that choice promises but doesn't always deliver. If we learn to speak to one another, albeit through translation, then we can begin to see choice in all its strangeness, complexity, and compelling beauty. Thank you.
Okay, so there was Sheena Iyengar, or Lyengar. That was a TED Talk, and she's talking about choice. And the problem that a lot of people have, you know, they tend to look at people, they just assume that, you know, that all people are the same, and that, you know, you can just measure people and they're all the same. People are all the same, and therefore you can do tests on them and measure this and measure that, and you can just make broad assumptions based on the test results, and they don't take into account morality, and, you know, or lack thereof, and so a lot of the things she was talking about, she's just assuming that she's looking at the concept of choice as if it's some sort of abstract thing that can somehow make people happy or cause people grief somehow, you know. And you know, in the case where she was talking about, oh, well, people make bad choices. They got too many choices, and then they make bad choices. Well, what causes people to make bad choices? Is it the fact that they have the choice? No. When people make bad choices, it reflects back on their character. They got character flaws. You know, help them with their character flaws. Let's talk about character flaws and how to best overcome character flaw problems. No. Can't do that. It's all these other things. Bad lifestyle. You got too many choices. You need to, you know, you're using too many resources. Killing the planet. You know, all this crap that they come up with. Global warming. You know, they come up with all this nonsense. And, you know, but it's never look at character. Oh, no, we can't look at character flaws. Can't make value judgments. No. So, I don't know. It's interesting. But you could hear her a couple of times there where I pointed it out. You could really hear her voice was just dripping with arrogance when she was talking about herself and these studies that she was doing and so on and so forth. And guarantee you, in her own mind, she thinks she knows best for, you know, she's so much smarter than these stupid people that are making the bad choices. And, you know, we need to repair society and take the choices away so that these stupid people will be happier with her in charge and people like her, because she's a good liberal. She's a good person. And that's the way these people think, you know, and they're arrogant. And they may not, I don't know, people often think that they, you know, if you're really arrogant, you can't, oftentimes you don't even know it. It's possible to be arrogant, and you know, somebody, you know, usually people that are arrogant don't know that they're arrogant. They can be dripping with arrogance and yet not be able to realize it. So, and not consider the fact, you know, they can't even conceive of considering that they might be arrogant. So anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting. A lot of these, I've been, you know, I watched a bunch of TED Talk videos, and I don't know. There's only probably a fairly small percentage of them that are really good, and then there's some of them that are sort of so-so, and then I don't know. Sometimes I run into a bunch of them that are really pretty mediocre. And, you know, the mediocre ones, you know, the great part of the fact it's a podcast or a video podcast or an audio podcast for that matter, if, you know, if I run into something that's really boring or really kind of mediocre, I just turn it off and, you know, go to the next. There's no point in watching something or listening to something, especially watching something that's kind of mediocre, that doesn't have any real value to it. There's no point in wasting your time on it, because there's more good material out there than it's possible to actually consume. And so there's no point in wasting time on, you know, kind of consuming mediocre stuff. So anyhow, probably better be cutting this off. Don't want to stay up too late. I'd rather kind of get to bed and maintain as reasonable sleep schedule as I possibly can. So in any case, hope everyone is having a great week so far, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.